Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott.
His full name is Exquisite Court Jester, King of Elation, but we call him Jester. He's an Afghan hound, black and tan. He's 18 months old.
If you want to meet some of the nation's most over-the-top pet owners, you'll find them backstage at the National Dog Show.
Oh, he's just a handsome boy. He has a husky face. He's liver-colored, and he has a white blaze on his chest.
2,000 beautiful dogs compete in this televised annual spectacle in different groups for the ultimate title of Best in Show.
And here they come, the sporting dogs, to lead us off. They're bred to assist the hunter. And here we go down the line, the English Setter, the Gordon Setter, the Irish
Setter. The dogs perform different tasks, they show off their looks, and they have to have lots of energy. So something these dog owners are really passionate about is their pet's health.
First and foremost, you make sure that you follow an excellent diet for the dogs, using a high-quality dog food.
Regular vet visits, getting them moving.
She's running on the treadmill because she needs exercise. It's very good for muscle.
He gets his walks every day. He gets two a day. Yeah, they probably walk about 40 minutes or more each day.
And of course, lots of love. But you don't have to go to a fancy dog show to meet pet owners who spare no effort or expense to make sure their furry friends are happy and healthy.
It sounds like Lucy's been doing pretty well at home.
I think so.
Yeah?
I mean, she's not losing any weight, even though she's on this restricted diet.
On today's episode, cats and dogs and us keeping them healthy. Let's get started with the cost of keeping your pet in good health. Vet visits are not cheap, and pet injuries and illnesses can quickly push humans into a financial crisis. Jad Slayman has more.
Girl meets cat.
Chips was this huge white cat with like little orange ears, and everyone would say that we looked alike because I have like big curly red hair.
A lot of pet stories start out sounding a bit like love stories.
I went through a lot in college, emotionally speaking, so he was always there for me. I would just like bury my face in his fur and cry, you know, and he would let me do that.
Michelle Goodwin and Chips were together for 5 years. She was a part-timer at a cafe, making minimum wage, but keeping up with routine vet visits. One day, Chips stopped eating and drinking. Michelle took him into the veterinary emergency room, and it turned out he couldn't urinate.
Basically, they get blocked, and then they can't release the toxins, and they just die. Like, their body poisons itself.
It cost $200 to clear up his urinary blockage, but it kept coming back, every 12 hours. The vet said Chips needed a surgery that cost $1,200.
It was the third time he had been on block, so I'd already paid $600 out of pocket. At that time, that was like pretty much a lot of my money. My rent was like $400.
Michelle's partner thought it was too much money to spend on a pet, and the clock was ticking.
It was like the end of the day. I knew that Chips was going to get blocked again, and I didn't want him to like die an excruciating death where his body like poisons himself.
There was a clinic nearby that offered free euthanasia. It was almost closing time.
And so I had like an hour to decide whether I was going to get the surgery, unblock him for another $300, or just like end it for free. And I just decided to end it for free.
She bundled Chips in his carrier for the last time and made it to the clinic.
The cat was sitting in the cat carrier, and there was like a little fish tank. And I remember he was so tired, like he was so sick and like so exhausted. But he like looked up at the fish tank, and his eyes kind of like got bright, like had a little bit of fire still flickering behind it. So it was like his last like cat kind of like primal moment, and he just like watched the fish.
Michelle works full-time now. She could cover that $1,200 today. Looking back, she says putting chips down was maybe the worst thing she's ever done.
And it's my I made that decision. Like, I didn't have to put him down. I could have paid for it. I could have figured out a way to pay for it.
I think Michelle was about to say it was her fault. But pet owners face gut-wrenching situations like Michelle's all the time. Each day, at least 200 of them call the Pet Fund's hotline.
My name is Karen Leslie. I'm executive director of the Pet Fund, and we pay for veterinary care for people who can't afford it.
The Pet Fund has been around since 2003. The team first went to shelters across the country to see what kind of diseases were killing our pets. They expected that maybe cancer would be the main problem, but instead it was poverty. People couldn't pay for treatment.
Things like, non-urgent orthopedic surgeries and just medication expenses that really made the difference between animal being dropped off at the shelter and likely euthanized or animal being able to stay with his or her family.
There's not much hard national data on this, what's called economic euthanasia. But from her end of the hotline, Karen says it's getting worse.
When we started, people who were unemployed, people who were, receiving disability, were the bulk of our calls. And now it is more people who are fully employed that are not able to afford these increased costs in veterinary care.
Analysts say the cost of vet care has been rising since the 90s at triple the rate of inflation. But don't blame the vets. As care costs have skyrocketed, veterinarian pay has actually declined slightly. Instead, Karen points to a couple things. One, the veterinary mom-and-pop private practice is giving way to the corporate chain, where prices are fixed. Compassionate vets just don't have as much flexibility to work with owners on price or payment plans.
It's very expensive to operate a veterinary clinic, and when a vet gets an offer from a corporation that makes their practice more viable, that makes sense in many instances.
According to a recent industry report, corporations now own nearly 1 in 5 American pet hospitals. Clinics that do go corporate are usually able to provide more advanced treatment. But Karen says that's the second thing driving costs. Pet MRIs used to be unheard of, but they're becoming the diagnostic norm, and they cost a couple $1,000. Advanced veterinary treatments now look a lot like human treatments, and they have similar price tags. But what about pet insurance? A certain TV dog got the first American pet insurance policy back in 1982. But still, today, only about 1% of pets are insured.
So some of the same issues that we have in human health insurance are even more exacerbated for animals, because if you or I go to the hospital, they're required to treat us in an emergency whether or not we have insurance. But that safety net does not exist for dogs and cats.
But why are so many pets uninsured in the first place? I reached out to a reporter who's covered pet health for over a decade, Jackie Brown. She says most people haven't even heard of pet insurance, but there's a lot of options out there. Her own pet policy was a lifesaver for her pup. But Jackie says you really got to read the fine print when shopping around.
They're all very different. There's no standardization within the industry. And some are, in my opinion and the opinion of others, more valuable than others.
First off, pet insurance is more like property insurance than human health insurance. Most work by reimbursement. If human health insurance worked the same way, you'd need to cough up a grand in the ER before the doctor resets your broken arm and then hang on to the receipt. Pet insurers also have more leeway in denying coverage than human insurers.
There will come an age, and it varies per company, where they say, your pet is too old, we will no longer insure them.
Wait,
even
what?
If you so wish you can... to continue.
That makes zero sense to me. So you can... What?
It's called aging out, and apparently it's pretty common.
The older they get, your premiums are going up and up and up, and it's like, oh my gosh. And eventually, we don't insure pets over the age of 15 or 14 or whatever it is. Like, that's, we're done with you.
After that, you're kind of stuck.
Pre-existing conditions are a thing in pet insurance. So if your pet has a pre-existing condition, a lot of times that is not going to be covered by a new insurance policy.
Yeah. Pre-existing conditions. Sound familiar? It's like how human health insurers used to be able to deny you coverage if you were previously diagnosed with diabetes, for instance, or if you'd had cancer.
Under this plan, it will be against the law for insurance companies to deny you coverage because of a pre-existing condition.
People insurance also used to have lifetime caps, aging out, essentially, before they were outlawed under the Affordable Care Act. During the human healthcare debate, lots of people pointed to Scandinavian healthcare as a kind of model for our broken system. And the world's first pet insurance policy was written in Sweden for a dog in 1924. So naturally, I reached out to a Swedish veterinarian.
Hi, my name is Linnea Kardfors, and I've always dreamt of becoming a veterinarian.
Her dream came true, and she's kind of the perfect vet to speak with because she practices in Sweden now, but started off in the United States.
I guess the biggest difference is about pet insurance. In Sweden, every person has pet insurance, and it covers everything except elective procedures.
If you want to declaw your cat, you're going to have to pay out of pocket. A bit of context may help frame the pet insurance disparity.
I'm not sure exact the year we got universal healthcare, but it's a natural thing for all Swedes, and therefore it's natural to have pet insurance for our animals.
The government doesn't provide Swedes pet insurance, but most of them buy it because universal coverage is just how they've always done things for themselves. This widespread coverage means Linnea got to leave behind one of the worst parts of her dream job when she left America.
Anytime it comes to economic euthanasia, it sucks. And that's the only way to put it. It's the most horrible thing.
I tell Linnea about Michelle and her cat, Chips, the one with the urinary blockage that was put down. The worst thing Michelle's ever done. But what if Chips had been Swedish?
It's a simple procedure. Of course, they have to stay in hospital and there's a risk for reoccurrence, but it's still a treatable condition.
And in the States?
I guess maybe we euthanize like one of them a day. Here in Sweden, I don't have that problem.
But just at that one American clinic Linnea worked at, every single day, a Michelle said goodbye to a Chips.
After Chips died, I truly felt like I couldn't love anything in the same way, or couldn't love another cat in the same way ever again, and I think that's kind of true still.
But she is trying. She got a new cat, Neptune, and she puts away a bit of money here and there, just in case.
Today you could.
Today
if,
I could.
If this happens to Neptune.
Yeah, I could save Neptune if it happened to him.
Jed Slayman reported that story. Many pet owners want to extend their pets' lives, no matter what the cost or what it will take. Daryl Whiting has had a lot of cats and dogs over the course of her lifetime, and for her, the last moments in a pet's life are precious. Tressa Versteg visited Daryl.
I'm a healer. I'm a giver. I love to bake. I love to cook. I'm not exciting. I'm 5'2", too heavy, just a typical little old lady.
So, there's the four dogs. We've got Raven, Mandy, Molly, and Rudy, fat little Rudy. And then we've got Squizzle the squirrel. And let me see if I can... Hector, come out here and don't bite me. Easy, Hector, easy. Hector has teeth like a pit bull. I mean, he bites. Oh, hecky, you're such a good boy.
As much as she loves her pets, Daryl accepts that death is part of their existence.
I feel sad. Unless the animal is just so sick that living is not a pleasure anymore. And in that case, euthanasia is a gift. You're releasing them from pain and sorrow. And if you're there and you're holding them, they know that somebody cares. The last one that I had to have put down was my Whippet, Fred. And at the end, he just looked so miserable, and his eyes just looked dull. And one day I brought him out to not go potty, but to go in the car, and we went to the vet, and I had him cremated, and his ashes are here around the house.
One day at work, Daryl overheard somebody say that they weren't present with their dog when it was time for the dog to be put down.
I said, "You didn't stay there?" "No. I didn't feel the need." I said, "You needed to be there. That animal needed to know that you were there for them." And somebody else heard me talking about it there at work, and they said, "Well, when I have to have my Cocker Spaniel put to sleep, will you take him for me?" And I said, "Yes, I'll take him for you."
She says her job prepared her for being present in these moments.
Well, I'm a retired registered nurse, and my thoughts on dying, I'm not afraid of death. I would cover deliveries, and one baby that we had so many anomalies. I mean, she was a tough-looking little kid, but to me, she was beautiful. I wrapped her up, and I held her until she died, and it took 8 hours. I've even had people ask me to sit with loved ones when they were dying. One in particular, I would work my shift at the hospital and then go sit with this man at night. And he fought for a couple of days, and I finally said, John, your wife is fine. Your kids are fine. It's time to go, so stop it. And he stopped breathing, and they all looked at me like, and he went. Everything dies. Even the sun's gonna die someday. And that's just part of the process. It's like I think of myself as a sunflower. I sprouted, I grew, I had kids, and I'm gonna go to seed.
That's Daryl Whiting. She spoke with audio producer Tressa Versteg. We're talking about pets, cats and dogs, and their health. One way to keep your pet healthy and to avoid medical problems down the road is to make sure they are at a healthy weight. Yup, same as for humans. And just like us, American pets have a weight problem. So what do? Put your cat and dog on a diet? It's easier said than done. Andrew Stelzer has more.
A few weeks ago, Sydney Scheiber got home to her small apartment in Berkeley, California. She opened the door, excited to see her three loving pets, a dog and two cats. Instead, she found a mess.
The Frosted Flakes box is on the floor. It's ripped to shreds. The bag's ripped open. And everyone in the house looks guilty, all three animals.
Scheiber took a video of the incident.
Is that you? Was that you? Was that you?
This was the second time in a week. A few days earlier, Sydney found her cat Penelope with her head inside a box of sugar cereal.
Penny, get out of there! What are you doing?
Sydney is very conscious about her pet's nutrition, and now she no longer keeps cereal in the house. While it might seem funny, her animals' diets are a serious issue, especially for her dog, an 11-year-old dachshund named Pepper. She inherited Pepper from her parents a couple of years ago when her mother passed away. On arrival, Pepper was obese. Tins full of cheese balls had been part of her everyday routine.
They had a Friday McDonald's day, my parents. They would get McDonald's and my dad would give her a piece of his burger. He'd give her French fries. If he had ice cream, she'd sit there on the other side of him and would lick the ice cream like while he's eating ice cream.
Pepper was lethargic. She didn't want to go anywhere. Sydney wasn't having it. She put her on a diet and got her outside a little more each week. The only treats she gets are fresh fruits and veggies, like the occasional carrot. Pepper's now muscular, healthy, completely different from the first 9 years of her life.
That was a lot of her youth, so she would have been a very playful, active dog, but she couldn't go on walks for an hour like she can now.
Sydney says her parents cared about Pepper. They didn't want her to be unhealthy. Veterinarian Laura Fossbender hears this kind of story a lot.
Food is love, you know? So especially with pets, we look to them for companionship and for sort of uncomplicated relationships. So, you know, if you can slip them a treat every so often and it makes them happy, it makes you happy.
The result is what many consider an epidemic. In the U.S., almost 100 million pets are overweight or obese, according to a 2016 study. Here at the University Veterinary Hospital in Berkeley, half the patients come in needing some counseling on weight control.
Hi, I'm Dr. Fossbender.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. So we got the whole family here,
yes,
it looks
do.
Like.
Awesome. They're all here.
This morning, Laura is seeing a family with three cats. One of them, a gray and white kitty named Lucy, is very obese. There's a 9-point scale to measure body condition. 1 is way too skinny. 5 is ideal. Lucy is an 8.
So it sounds like Lucy's been doing pretty well at home.
I think so.
Yeah?
I mean, she's not losing any weight, even though she's on this restricted diet, supposedly.
Yeah.
We have this machine, I don't know if you know about this, that like helps determine which animal's eating the thing, and then opens and closes.
Ellen Schwerin and Eamon Darrow bought a special feeder and put a chip around each cat's neck. The chip opens or closes the door on the feeder and is supposed to regulate how much food each animal gets. But Lucy has somehow learned how to game it. She's actually gained weight in the past year. Today's suggestions from the doctor include low-calorie foods or more regular feeding times. The general strategy is to reduce the number of calories consumed by 10% every month.
Maybe an ideal weight of 10 to 11 pounds.
I know, that seems crazy.
But, you know, what I would aim for with her is probably 12 pounds and then see where we're at.
To lose 4 pounds.
But yeah. I get 2 cats in one right now.
Right?
She's so, she's so delicious.
It's tricky because I can see she's happy, you know, and it's sweet and she enjoys the eating, but at the same time, we have to be parents and, you know, keep her in line. So unfortunately, some tough decisions are going to have to be made in her benefit.
Those benefits are huge. Obese cats and dogs are at risk of kidney disease, heart failure, and spinal damage, among other health problems. Many of the same ailments that affect obese humans. And perhaps it's not surprising, the incidence of obesity in pets is also roughly the same for people. About half of Americans are also overweight. Laura the vet says this issue needs to be discussed more openly and with honesty.
It is a struggle, you know, like I struggle with my weight. There's other folks in here who struggle with their weight. The pet owner can sometimes have a struggle with the weight. It can be a sensitive topic for people, you know, to talk about.
I found the best evidence for how tough this issue is to address in the back room of the vet clinic, where I was introduced to a black and white kitty named Maui. Maui lives here at the hospital, surrounded by vets and other knowledgeable professionals.
It's everyone's responsibility. So he has his little feeding schedule, and he actually has a little weight log where we weigh him every month or so. And yet, here we are.
On the 9-point body scale, where 1 is skinny and 5 is healthy, Maui is a 9. For The Pulse, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Today's episode is about cats and dogs, and so far we've talked about their health, but now let's take a look at how pets impact our health. Having a cat or dog can mean that you feel less lonely or less depressed. Dogs get you out for walks, but sometimes pets can add to stress. For example, in the beautiful city of Paris, dogs contribute to a lot of strife among residents. They're fighting because dog owners are not picking up what the dogs are leaving behind. Reporter Marjorie Hash has been following this mucky affair in Paris. Hey, Marjorie.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Why is dog poo such a big problem in Paris?
Well, first of all, Paris is a very densely populated capital. Now, it isn't the biggest size-wise, so it's only 41 square miles, but it does have a population of 2.2 million people, and there are an estimated 300,000 pet pooches living in the city who generate 22 tons of feces per year. Now, that's the equivalent of 3 Olympic swimming pools of poo.
I'm sure that's not in the tourist brochures as one of the factoids.
Absolutely. It's so bad that when foreigners move to Paris, they're often shocked. I spoke to Cherie Nicol, who came here from Scotland 3.5 years ago, and she has very strong views on the matter.
There is dog poop everywhere. I would say the most important thing is when you're walking, don't look up, don't look at your phone, just look where your feet are, because this stuff is everywhere. you can spot it before you come to it, because there's usually like a trail of footprints, of brown footprints, because everybody steps in it.
And just to give you an example, when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, my mother had a designated knife she kept behind the toilet to remove all the dog muck from our shoes.
So all of this is obviously gross, but is it a risk for human beings in terms of their health?
Well, I went to talk to Dr. Gérard Cohen, who's been a primary care physician for 40 years in the French capital, And he says that dogs are carriers of bacteria like E. coli and other pathogens.
It's true that you can be contaminated with parasites like worms.
And he's quick also to point out that these worm contaminations aren't all that common.
People are more at risk in terms of sleeping on dog poo than in terms of catching infections.
Indeed, some 650 Parisians end up in hospital every year with injuries acquired as a result from slipping on dog muck. And there are also reports of people getting into violent fights over dog owners leaving their pets' mess in certain areas. As for staying clear of the pathogens, he says people should definitely take their shoes off when they get home.
So has the city done anything to fight all of the dog poop?
Well, one of the big measures that was put in place under Jacques Chirac, who was mayor of Paris before he became the French president in the 90s, was the motocrotte. Now, that's a big green motorbike with a tank on the back and a sort of vacuum hose. And it would parade around the streets of Paris and suck up unwanted dog turds. Now, all those motocrottes lasted quite a few years, through to the early 2000s, when authorities suddenly realised that this measure was costing them 4.5 million euros per year, but that only 20% of the poo was actually being sucked up, so it wasn't really worth it. So since then, fines for dog droppings have gone up to nearly 70 euros, but it's actually not that easy to catch people out doing the dirty. Christine Buckley is originally from New York City and has been living in Paris for 13 years. She has a dog named T-Rex, and she says your average Parisian dog owners still haven't really changed their behavior.
It's really funny because I always have a roll of bags in my pocket, and sometimes I used to think, oh, that poor person, they found themselves without a bag. Oh, here. Oh, hi, Monsieur, Madame, would you like a bag? And almost every time the person's gotten offended. Like, it's not your business to tell me whether I should pick up my poo.
Now, some other French citizens have tried to take things into their own hands and created various apps where you can geolocalize a turd so as to warn other people. Over in the United Kingdom, some private parks have brought out a system where the owners have to give their dog's DNA to the keepers if they want to use the facility, so that should any turd be found, the canine culprit and owners can be identified.
Marjorie, you've lived in Paris for quite some time now. Have you seen any improvement in terms of dog poo or people's behavior?
Well, I have to say that even though there's still a lot of dog poop, it's not as bad as it used to be. For example, 15 or 20 years ago, there used to be poop scrapers everywhere to clean your shoes just outside buildings, and they're no longer there. So perhaps that's a sign that they're no longer deemed as necessary.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Marjorie Hash is a reporter living in Paris. We're talking about cats and dogs, their health, and ours. What do you do when the usually sweet kitty you love becomes angry and aggressive? Carol Zoll had to seek help in stabilizing her cat's mood.
That's Jordy. He's a brown tabby with big yellow-green eyes. And he likes to eat. He is a big boy, 21 pounds, good at purring. Jordy's generally a happy cat, but he's also a scaredy cat. He's skittish and easily startled. About a year and a half ago, my neighbor's cat, Sugar Plum, wandered onto my back deck. Jordy's an indoor cat, but the back door was open and he saw Sugar Plum through the screen. Suddenly, he went into full attack mode. He puffed up to twice his usual size and became this growling, hissing, swiping ball of fur and fangs. Nobody wants to get in the middle of a cat fight, but I did get close enough to slam the back door and try to get out of Jordy's way. But he was still mad and lunged at me. He got his claws into the back of my ankles, deep enough to draw blood. He was one angry feline, and I was one shaken human. Jordy kept growling and hissing at me for about a week, much longer than normal for a cat to stay riled. Plus, even after he calmed down, I was still kind of afraid of him. So I consulted veterinarian Nicholas Dodman. He's written a bunch of bestsellers on animal behavior, including the cat who cried for help. He diagnosed Jordy with something called redirected aggression. It's a problem that often starts exactly the way it happened with Jordy and Sugar Plum.
The cat inside the house goes into what's called the feline affective aggression state. The pupils of their eyes dilate like big black circles, and they may unsheath their claws and swat at the offending object. But here, if they can't reach the offending object, they will often redirect the ire that they're feeling. They redirect onto the nearest object.
I was the nearest object.
It's a little bit like an angry man punching a wall. So the wall didn't do anything, but he gets in a terrible temper and he punches a hole in the wall. I knew a guy who did that. And that's called redirected aggression.
Usually the redirected aggression is focused on another cat who lives in the same house, but sometimes the target is a person. For us, the vet recommended two things. First, avoidance. Eliminate any possibility for Jordy to see, smell, or hear another cat. So we screened off our back deck, scrubbed it with pet deodorizer, and covered all our windows with adhesive film so he couldn't see out. And the second prescription was medication.
Your cat is very excitable. He's likely to get into a tizzy. So that trait can't be changed except with medicine.
The medicine, in this case Prozac, was supposed to make Jordy less fearful and less likely to overreact to scary situations. At first, I wasn't sure about putting my cat on Prozac, but then I thought, well, some of my friends have been on Prozac for years. Why not Jordy? There aren't many side effects, and lots of dogs and cats are on it for problems like aggression, noise phobia, and separation anxiety. And the vet, Nicholas Dodman, says he's also used Prozac for horses, parrots, and even a pig. My friend Catherine's dog, Crash, has been on Prozac for about a decade.
Crashy, come here. Come here. Good girl. Good girl. Okay, come on.
Crash is a beagle mix, and she's really sweet, but she used to lunge at other dogs and try to attack.
And she just wouldn't stop. You could not get her off of a dog. Our fear was she was going to kill the dog.
That's when Crash went on Prozac. She also needed some behavior training to help rein in her instincts.
And so now it's just a quick redirect with the leash. If we encounter a dog on the street, we can redirect that behavior.
It's been a really long time since Crash had any problems. Recently, Catherine and her wife wondered if Crash even needed Prozac anymore.
We decided, you know, maybe we should taper this off. And we did try it for a couple of weeks. And she kind of went back to her old behavior, so we put her back on it.
A lot of pets do actually come off drugs like Prozac after a few months. But for Jordy, it's a tough call. I don't know if Prozac has permanently altered his brain chemistry, but he seems less fearful. If the doorbell rings or if he hears a vacuum cleaner, he's less likely to run under the bed. But I have to admit, I still get nervous that he might turn on me again. So for now, I'm going to keep giving him that pill.
That was Carol Zoll reporting. All right, so this is sort of turning into our when animals attack portion of the show, but here it goes. Every year, thousands of Americans end up in the hospital because of dog bites. Elena Johns is one of them. She's a dog owner herself. She has a tiny Chihuahua Yorkie mix. She says they're called Chorkies. And she was stepping out of a shop in Philadelphia carrying this Chorkie. Another dog owner was walking next to her with a much bigger dog.
It saw me. It turned around and it lunged. It had a slack leash. Boom. I didn't even know that I had been bitten until I felt the pain in my arm.
What did the other dog owner do? What did you do?
I realized I had been bitten, and I was wearing, I remember, a hoodie sweatshirt. I rolled up my arm, and I saw the tooth marks, and I saw that the dog had broken the skin. There was some blood, and the man was standing on the sidewalk a few feet away from me, and I said, "Your dog bit me," and looked at me for a minute. He said, "What are you, a Trump voter?" And then he ran away into the crowd.
What?
This is what happened.
So I guess obviously he didn't care.
He didn't care that I had been injured by his animal. And there's the issue of the health risk to me. If I had been able to find out who he was and if his dog is up to date on its vaccinations, then the whole situation would have been a lot different for me.
Elena was really shaken up by what had happened and scared.
I went home. I disinfected the bite. I iced it for a while. And my arm started to swell up and turn purple, and I couldn't use it. It was very painful. So come Monday morning, as early as I could, I called a phone number the city has to report dog bites. And I told them what had happened to me. And the person on the line said, "Did the bite break the skin?" I said, "Yes." And she said, "Is there swelling?" I said, "Yes." And she said, "Do you know the rabies status of the dog that bit you?" And I said, "No." And she said, "You need to go to your doctor right now."
Elena saw a nurse practitioner who said, "You need to go to the emergency room and get rabies shots. They didn't have that vaccine at the doctor's office because it's so rarely needed." Elena was hesitant. Was that really necessary? And the nurse told her,
"There's no cure for rabies." So off to the ER I went.
And this wasn't just one shot. It was a whole series of them, and Elena had to go back to the ER 3 more times for the vaccination to be complete. Elena says this experience has made her much more aware of how people handle their dogs if they're attentive.
Dogs bite for a lot of reasons, and all dogs of any breed can bite.
That's Patricia Benz. She is a canine behavioral therapist in Philadelphia, and she often works with dogs that bite.
Bites can range anywhere from maybe a slight puncturing of the skin or scratching of the skin all the way to a mauling. Honestly, if you've got a very large breed, particularly any breed that has a tendency to lock in and hold on a bite, and the dog's exhibited the behavior before, typically we really don't rehab those dogs.
Patricia says one of the best things owners can do to prevent bites is to catch certain behaviors early. For example, recognize when a dog is stressed or scared.
So that can be anywhere from a little growl to piloerection, which is the hackles going up on the back, a nose wrinkling, lip lifting, whale eye, which is, you know, that kind of an odd stare that some of you get, that freezing motion.
When you see those signs, pay attention and get your dog out of whatever stressful situation is happening. Otherwise, they might bite. They may need space from other dogs or people. Patricia says it's also important not to punish dogs for that kind of behavior.
Because number one, what does it do? It increases the dog's stress, which doesn't help. Dogs can't learn when they're under stress. So we don't want the dog to get worse. We don't want to suppress a growl because the growl is a warning that there is a problem. And when dogs are punished for the growl, they don't growl and then they just go right to the bite. So growling, even though people think it's a terrible, horrible thing, that growling can be the precursor to later behavior that's much more problematic. So address it early. The dog's trying to communicate and people just really don't fully understand that.
Patricia Benz is a canine behavioral therapist. Many cat owners find themselves in a bit of a predicament. They want their cats to have some freedom, to be able to go outside. That's something bird lovers can get pretty mad about because cats can really decimate wildlife. But it also poses a risk for the cats because of all the dangers that lurk out there. So what's better, outdoor or indoor cat? Reporter Liz Tung is going through this decision-making process right now with her cat. So Liz, tell me about your cat.
So my cat's name is Ahab, and she is 5 years old.
What is it, Ahab? Wanna go outside? Okay, fine.
And I'm just gonna show you a picture of her.
All right, she's cute. Little black kitty with a white nose. She's a sweet cat?
She is an adventurous cat. She likes to play. She likes to go outside and hunt.
Do you want to go outside? But you've already been outside like 3 times today. All right. I'll let you out. She's running outside. She just jumped up. Oh, and she's standing on her hind legs, peering through the fence into our neighbor's backyard. You see anything, Ahab?
And that was pretty much her life for the first 3 years.
Little tail is wagging. Her ears are all perked up. She's sniffing the wind.
How did you end up with Ahab?
Yeah, so I got Ahab about 5 years ago when she was a kitten. I lived in China for a few years. And so I adopted her while I was there. And she had a lot of spirit. So I felt like I couldn't keep her indoors. She was always trying to venture out. And it was like in China, it's very common to let cats outdoors. So I really didn't think twice about it.
And then you came to the U.S.?
Yeah, so that's when everything changed. Me and my husband, Wooly, and Ahab, the three of us moved to New York, and we moved into like this tiny Brooklyn apartment where it was just impossible for her to go outside. So she basically became an indoor cat.
And how did she adjust to that?
She did not adjust very well. she was used to having her freedom. And so all of a sudden she was confined in this tiny apartment with tons of energy. And so she just wanted to play all the time. That's all she wanted to do. And, you know, there really weren't enough hours in the day for us to play with her and keep her entertained. And Wooly, my husband, started to notice that she was getting frustrated.
Well, definitely. I mean, in the flat after that, I really started to notice, again, because she couldn't go outside, that she was a little bit angsty. She bit me once. And she'd never really done that before. She'd never been aggressive or anything. And I think she was just bored. I think she just like lacked the stimulation.
I guess that's understandable. If she was, you know, she was always outside and now she's stuck in this little tiny place.
Yeah, and it wasn't just that she was bored. It's like she actually seemed miserable. And this is something that Wooly and I started talking about a lot, like pretty much on a weekly basis.
Because if you think about it, like she's a little life form and we know what happens to people when they're in like prison. Like it's really not good for your mental state. You know, it's always a toss up between keeping her safe and not letting her outside, but having a cat that's depressed and unhappy and might act out a bit, than having a cat who has the freedom to enjoy life.
So you're psychoanalyzing the cat at this point. So what did you decide to do? What happened next?
So we had to keep her inside when we were in New York, but luckily we moved out of New York and into a place that had a little yard where it was once again possible to let her outside.
In Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia. And we decided to book an appointment with the vet so that she could get all of her shots so that we could let her outside again. And while we're there, the vet just completely freaks us out. Like he starts listing off all of the horrible things that can happen to cats when they go outside, you know, get hit by a car or get in a fight with another cat, get some kind of disease. And then he finishes with, if you value your cat, you will not let her go outside.
Ooh. So what did you do?
Well, at first we kept her inside and I mean, I was surprised by what he said. And so I started searching around online to see what other experts say. And I ended up reaching out to this researcher who studies how environment affects cats' welfare. Her name is Candace Crony.
I'm a professor of animal behavior and well-being at Purdue University.
And I was actually surprised by what she said.
There's no standard blanket answer in terms of what's best for the cat. That really is just a function of what you're looking for, what your definition of good welfare is, what makes for good quality of life for an animal.
So that's a little bit different than what the vet said.
Yeah, and this is actually a question that she poses to her ethics class at the veterinary school there.
It's simply the case of which cat has better quality of life. So I give them a case of the indoor cat living a long and possibly relatively boring life indoors versus the cat that is outdoors or indoor-outdoor. It's very well exercised, it's very mentally stimulated, and at the relatively young age of 5 years old, meets its nemesis, the moving car, at high speed, and then the cat says goodbye to us all. And I'm almost always shocked that people pick cat number two, almost every time.
But do you really think cats get depressed when they are not outside, or is that just a human emotion that we put on them?
So I was actually wondering that, and I reached out to a cat behaviorist who you might have heard of.
Hey, everybody, this is your cat daddy, Jackson Galaxy.
Here. He actually had this show called My Cat from Hell, and this is what he said.
Yeah, of course I've seen depression. As a human, if you knew you were on this planet to do one thing, and that one thing you were not permitted to do, you would also be anxious and depressed. And from a DNA standpoint, they are programmed to wake up, hunt, catch, kill, and eat.
So this is what cat behaviors call the seeking circuit. It's this part of their brain that drives them to hunt and releases dopamine when they do.
Is there any way to strike a balance, so to give the cats this excitement, but also keep them safe?
Yeah, so that's actually what Jackson teaches owners to do, and what he was trying to advise me to do, is just play with your cat more.
There's so many ways that you can split the difference, and it is definitely a harder parenting choice to do the work, you know, as opposed to open the door.
So, Liz, what have you and Wooly decided to do with Ahab now?
She is still going outside. We are talking about it. But I have told Wooly that, especially after hearing once again all of the horrible things that can happen to cats when they go outside, that I really do want to try and bring her in. So currently making plans to see about making that happen.
Close the door.
Close the door.
Thanks, Liz.
Thanks, Megan.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yip. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Andy Copes is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.